From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
And from NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And voters are heading out to participate in two special congressional elections today, one in South Carolina to decide who will replace Mick Mulvaney, now President Trump's budget director. And then there's Georgia. You've probably heard the race to fill the seat formerly held by Tom Price, now Secretary of Health and Human Services, is the most expensive House race in U.S. history. After an election in April, this runoff pits Republican Karen Handel against the Democrat John Ossoff. It's been seen as a test of the Trump presidency, and the president has been tweeting this morning to get out the vote for the Republican. Bradley George of Here Now contributor Georgia Public Radio is watching it all. And so, Bradley, what's been going on in the polls? Do we see turnout?
Yes, we have seen a big turnout in the early voting phase. About 140,000 people cast ballots in the last couple of weeks. Turnout today has been pretty steady. I imagine once people get off work around 4 or 5 o'clock that we'll see a rush at the polls. The weather doesn't look so great in Atlanta today. That could affect turnout as well.
Well, the AP spoke with voters in the 6th District about how they're feeling. Let's start with David Ware.
We have a chance to make a decision about who's going to lead us, whether the president is there or is not there, whether his policies are good or bad. We need to have someone that we can depend on and rely on to make our voice heard. One congressman out of 435 really can't make a tremendous difference, but they can certainly have an impact locally.
And here's another one, Tom Greathouse.
There's been a ton of emotion involved, and I think Washington has played a part in this election, and I think emotion is good. That gets people out, and it gets people talking, and ultimately, I hope it gets things done.
So some voters speaking to the AP in Johns Creek, Georgia. But Bradley, how do people feel largely about so much outside participation in this race, all the money coming in, all the workers coming in? How do they feel about it?
Oh, it's crazy. All the journalists coming in as well. This is a race that's gotten attention all around the world. I think people are going to be relieved that this is finally coming to an end. You know, we had a first round of voting in April where there were 18 candidates in the running. And then since then, it's been this slog between Ossoff and Handel. So I think it's going to be a relief. And you heard a little bit in that voter tape that you played that people are aware that, you know, this is just one congressperson that's serving part of a term. And they're not going to have a whole lot of impact, but they want somebody who ultimately is going to represent the interests of this suburban Atlanta district.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that ad from a conservative PAC that blamed last week's baseball practice shooting on Ossoff and liberal Democrats. And you had a Republican official there, Brad Carver, tell the New York Times, "I think the shooting is going to win this election for us, the Republicans." Now, the ad was odious to both the candidates, but the Republican Handel didn't ask for it to be pulled. What effect do you think that ad will have?
I don't know if it is going to have much of an effect. I haven't seen the ad on TV. I think it's gotten more play in the news media and on social media than it has as a television piece. But it's interesting that you bring up the shooting and Steve Scalise, who was mm-hmm. the congressman from Louisiana, who was seriously injured in that. On his campaign Twitter this morning, he tweeted out, "Karen Handel is a great candidate, and hashtag Team Scalise is pulling for her."
Right. Well, what else do you think we should know about this? We noted in the minute that we have, we noted that much has been made of the fact that this is a district which is considered to be very educated, and mm-hmm. Democrats are targeting what they think are districts that might maybe move away from Trump. Thoughts?
Yeah, because if you go back to 2016, Tom Price, who's now the HHS secretary, he won re-election by a wide margin. Donald Trump, though, only won this district by 2 points. So you probably had a lot of people who were splitting their tickets, voting for Tom Price and then maybe voting for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. John Ossoff is hoping to cleave off some of those votes. He got about 8 to 10% of the GOP vote in the first round. And he's hoping to get that and maybe pick up a little bit more to take him over the top.
Well, still a big challenge for him. The seat been held by Republicans for 40 years.
Well, there's news about the late actress Carrie Fisher. Her autopsy revealed that she had multiple drugs in her system at the time of her death in December, including cocaine, methadone, ecstasy, opiates, and alcohol. The cause of death was listed as sleep apnea along with heart disease and drug use, although it's not clear how significant the mixture of drugs in her system was. But mixing drugs, especially combining uppers and downers, is dangerous. Joining us now via Skype to talk about that is Daryl Inaba, Clinical and Behavioral Health Services Director at Addictions Recovery Center in Medford, Oregon. Daryl Inaba, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And what are the risks of combining uppers and downers?
Well, there's a huge risk, and it's been done and led to a lot of deaths throughout history. People combine those different drugs, especially psychoactive drugs, to either boost the effects or to minimize side effects or to get unique effects. And when they do so, drugs sometimes work together in additive form, or sometimes they have synergistic, actually have greater than additive combinations. Sometimes they mask toxic effects and bad effects, and it makes somebody more likely to have an overdose.
And how often does that happen, an overdose because of the combination of an upper and a downer, or multiple uppers and downers?
I think we're having this heroin or opiate epidemic with a lot of deaths, and I think a lot of them are due to a combination, but usually combination of a downer with a downer, something like a benzodiazepine, like a Klonopin or a Xanax along with the opiates. And then more recently, a lot more people are doing uppers and downers together. The old speedball that John Belushi was alleged to have died of, and growing concern, more and more people combining a stimulant like methamphetamine or cocaine with an opiate like heroin, methadone, or Oxycontin. In that combination, there's toxic effects from both those drugs that aren't realized. Some people think they antagonize or they block each other's effect, when in fact they actually augment the toxic effects of each other.
Hmm. What about prescription drugs combined with illegal drugs?
Yeah, prescription drugs are basically CNS or central nervous system acting drugs that can oftentimes have side effects and have contraindications when they're given with each other. And usually when they're prescribed, the pharmacists and the doctors are monitoring that and warn patients about it. But occasionally when a psychiatrist or doctor, especially psychiatrists, are trying to treat mental illness, they often combine a lot of different psychotropic drugs, trying to control things like depression or anxiety or even thought disorder, and in the process expose somebody to much more toxic effects of each drug.
Are you surprised that people are using so many different drugs together at the same time? I mean, when we hear about Carrie Fisher, for example, just what she had in her system at the time of her death, cocaine, methadone, ecstasy, there was Oxycontin in there, just a lot of different things at the same time. It sounds surprising to me. What about to you?
No, I think that's more common, especially as one develops chemical dependency or addiction. They often gain tolerance. They get resistant, and they're not gaining the effects that they really want out of a certain drug. So they often supplement that by adding different drugs. And in doing so, I think it's more norm that we have people who get involved with drugs who end up taking a combination of drugs.
What can be done about this? Anything?
I think more and more education, more and more awareness within the pharmaceutical industry. Physicians get in trouble when they overprescribe and they prescribe too many combinations. As we crack down and continue to monitor, and I think many states are now, if you're going to prescribe a controlled substance, they put it in a computerized data bank. And they monitor these practices and try to regulate that a lot. And that's having some success. But the untoward effect it's having is as this becomes more and more scrutinized, then the user will turn to street drugs. And we're just having a slew of very powerful synthetic opiates and synthetic stimulants, and a lot of things are just exploding right now. This sort of reminds me of the whole drug explosion that happened in the 60s with street chemists making up a whole slew of new psychoactive substances.
Do you think it's harder for someone who takes multiple drugs at the same time, who mixes uppers and downers, to break their addictions?
Oh, it very much is. And it's actually dangerous because in addiction treatment, we treat the drugs that persons are addicted to, and some of the withdrawal symptoms or some of the physical addictions are very dangerous. Alcohol, for instance, the sedatives, all the sedative drugs, can actually result in withdrawal seizures and death, whereas withdrawing from opiates will result in a very bad physical flu or symptoms like a physical flu, and withdrawing from stimulants usually results in depression. So if you're treating somebody who comes in, say, for methamphetamine abuse or cocaine abuse, and you just suspect or don't realize that they're also abusing a opiate or benzodiazepine, then the person will go into withdrawal that you weren't aware of and can often lead to death if you don't have medical resources to deal with it.
That's Daryl Inaba, who is a clinical and behavioral health services director at Addictions Recovery Center in Medford, Oregon. He's also one of the original founders of the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic in San Francisco. Daryl, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeremy.
It's Here and Now, and this week marks 8 years since the death of Michael Jackson. And we're going to look back at some of his music now in this week's Here and Now DJ Sessions. Anthony Valadez is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I remember where I was 8 years ago when I heard about the death of Michael Jackson. And I remember the other thing that happened then, which was that all the radio stations just started playing nonstop Michael Jackson. And when you would go to a bar or a club or whatever, they were playing Michael Jackson for weeks and weeks and weeks.
I remember being at the Apple store and hearing some kid kind of mumble to his mother, Michael Jackson died or had a heart attack, and I didn't want to believe it. And I also remember hearing Michael Jackson on the streets, all the cars playing his music really loud. It was definitely a surreal time.
Well, and some people remember him for his later stuff that he did solo. Some people remember him for the things that he was doing with the Jackson 5. We're going to talk about some from all parts of his career today, and let's get to the first one. This is from the Jackson 5. This is the 1969 song, Who's Lovin' You? Such a young and sweet voice there. He was 11 or 12 years old.
And that's the thing that blows me away about little Michael is somebody to belt out that kind of vocal. I mean, had to have had some kind of life experience.
And he was one of the younger brothers in the Jackson 5, but of course he went on to become the most famous. How did he make his mark early on?
You know, I think there was something about him. I'm one of those guys who loves to go through the rabbit hole of YouTube, and I've asked myself that question, and I've always watched their performances. Everything he did, he accented, whether it was a kick, whether it was an ad-lib. There was always that thing that Michael had that his brothers just didn't. I mean, shout out to them if they're listening. I'm sure you guys are all great in your own respective fields, but you are no Michael.
Well, and maybe he realized he didn't need them to be a star. This is from 1972. This is from his debut studio album. This is called Got to Be There. Now, this is not one that gets a lot of radio play, Anthony. I can't even really remember this one.
You know, I wanted to sprinkle in some deep cuts because that's the beautiful thing about his legacy is even his deep cuts, his B-sides, his rarities are just as impactful as his hits. This is the song, actually. I'll share this with you. I was very much looking forward to falling in love because of this song. I was about 4 years old. Mm. By the way, way after the fact, just if anybody's trying to figure out my age. But when I heard this song as a kid, I couldn't wait to fall in love. So I had to sprinkle that in there as well.
And this is off of his debut studio album.
That's correct. People think it started with Off the Wall, but it actually started in 1972 with this record. So they were kind of putting him out in front at a very early age without his brothers, which, you know, I always wonder, how did that sit with Michael, being by yourself without your support group? and, you know, still executed very well and got to shine.
All right. Well, next we are going to get into my time of life, which is the 80s and 1982. This is one that I just, you know, it has taken on a new meaning since he died. It feels like I realize how great this song is. This is from Thriller. This is Human Nature.
Reaching out, touch a stranger. Electric eyes are everywhere. See that girl. She knows I'm watching. She likes the way I stare. If they say why, tell them that it's human nature. Why do they do it that way? If they say why, tell them that it's human nature.
Hey, can I ask you a question, Jeremy?
Yes.
Definitely. But you said something that struck me. You said that this song has taken on a new meaning. What is that meaning to you? I'm curious.
It's taken on a new meaning because I didn't realize how high up on the list of Michael Jackson songs this was for me until after he died. And I went and I, you know, got onto Pandora and Spotify and I started downloading all of his songs and just listening to Michael Jackson after he died. And I realized that this was one of my favorites and it hadn't been before.
And that's why I asked you that question. Same with me. The night he passed, it was a Thursday. During the day, and I had a DJ that night, and of course I played a lot of Michael, but I drove home. I took the long way home, and I put this song on repeat because there was something about the vibe, and it took on a new meaning for me that night. And also I want to point out that this song exemplifies the legacy of Michael Jackson. It's produced by Quincy Jones, but sampled by, you know, a lot of R&B stars like SWV. Miles Davis covered this song. John Mayer covered this song, and it shows that Michael didn't just appeal to little kids in the neighborhood, but he appealed to gang members in LA when he shot Thriller. He appealed to dancers, to so many different communities, and that's something that's really hard to do these days.
Well, and in the film This Is It, which looks at the performance that he was trying to put together right before he died, he sings this and they play most of it, and you see how he accents certain parts of the song. You start to notice things about it that you don't when you listen to the album version of it.
That's a great point. In that movie, you get to see Michael craft his performance to the song. I remember when this came out on HBO, he did a live performance of this song and he incorporated the popping, the breaking. But, you know, later down the line, he incorporates different dance movements. So you really get to see firsthand how Michael, he strived for perfection and never stopped. With a song like this, he still continued to attempt to perfect.
And this was from Thriller, which, by the way, became the best-selling album of all time, selling tens of millions of copies around the world. How important was Thriller from a musical and cultural standpoint?
Oh, man. Cultural standpoint, I can tell you this, that it was what he did with videos was so unique. Also, I think folks tend to forget, but MTV at that time wasn't really playing a lot of videos from African Americans. You know, culturally speaking, he had to break down barriers with Thriller, and he did it in a way that moved us as listeners in a way where we're talking in 2017 about how that one song impacted us.
Let's get to the next one, which brings us to the 1990s. This is Remember the Time off of Dangerous.
Do you remember us holding hands? Remember me just up because I'm at this day. Remember the time when we fell in love. Remember the time when we first met, girl. Remember the time when we fell in love. Do you remember?
Just a great dance beat there. This is from 1991.
Well, that's the New Jack Swing, produced by Teddy Riley, by the way, who is the father of the New Jack Swing. And you can kind of hear that in Remember the Time. There's a little swing in there. And also, how can we forget the iconic video with Eddie Murphy, Iman,
right,
and Magic Johnson? And also, when Michael put out a song, an album, or a video, it was an experience. I remember watching The Simpsons, and you had to watch after for the world premiere of this video. It was such a great time, 1991, man.
Yeah, that was a good time. When, back when we had 29 channels, and that was it.
Exactly. So yeah, Michael had an experience with this. And then the whole routine, you remember the dance routine, which when I play this song, everybody loves to do the routine in the club, which is kind of cool.
Well, and his music brought so much joy to people, many of them on the dance floor. But he did have a lot of struggles. And in 2009, at the age of 50, he died suddenly. His doctor was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for administering too much of a medication that Jackson took to sleep. But Michael Jackson had been in the midst of a comeback. What are your thoughts 8 years later about the legacy of Michael Jackson?
Nobody comes close. And we're seeing his influence, his legacy live on through Usher, Justin Timberlake, even rappers, which I love, is that he's influenced so many different people. He's reminded us to love the world, to love ourselves, to that change begins with ourselves. And so he was able to convey these important messages while also entertaining us, while watching him become a wolf, while watching him dance with the Egyptians. You know, he was a storyteller and he was an entertainer, but most importantly, he reminded us that self-value and love for one another is very important, and I think that's something to carry with us today.
That's Anthony Valadez of KCRW speaking with us about Michael Jackson. Anthony, the one thing I'm sad about is you didn't play Rock With You, which I think is another one of his great songs, but there are so many we could name.
I was going for deep cuts. Plus, a little interesting fact, I won my ninth grade talent competition in junior high dancing to Michael Jackson. I did a routine. So,
Well,
thought we'd end on that note.
We'll put the video at our website, hereandnow.org. Anthony, thanks as always.
Please don't, and thanks.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Vigils are planned in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Philadelphia, and in the Reston, Virginia hometown of a 17-year-old Muslim girl named Nabra Hassanin, who police in Fairfax County, Virginia, say was murdered in a fit of road rage, not in a hate crime. Nabra and a group of friends were observing Ramadan overnight Saturday. They'd gone to eat early Sunday morning and were returning to their mosque when one of them got into an argument with the suspect, Darwin Martinez Torres. Police spokeswoman Julie Parker spoke to reporters last night.
Nothing indicates that this was motivated by race or by religion. It appears the suspect became so enraged over this traffic argument that it escalated into deadly violence.
That violence, police say Torres kidnapped Nabra Hassanin, beat her with a baseball bat, and dumped her body in a pond. WAMU's Carmel Dashad is here. And Carmel, you are Muslim. What are people in the community saying? Road rage.
I think there's some skepticism in the community where they feel like maybe their concerns are being overlooked from the law enforcement community. A lot of people are seeing this quote-unquote road rage incident as something similar to what happened in Chapel Hill a few years ago with a parking dispute. They're wondering, you know, if the crux of the problem really was road rage, and does road rage lead to beating somebody with a bat, murdering them, and then dumping their body?
Well, remind us what happened in Chapel Hill.
So there were a husband and wife and the wife's sister that were killed by a neighbor. Authorities say it was over a parking dispute. The family of both the Abu Salha family and the Barakat family dispute that. They say that this was something that was motivated by the suspect for an animus against the Muslim religion. They don't believe the, you know, official line that this was a parking dispute.
Well, and in fact, you mentioned that people are thinking of that crime, and there was a direct representation of that crime. Didn't the brother of one of the murder victims come to Virginia?
That's correct. So the brother of Diet Buttercott, Ferris Buttercott, drove overnight from North Carolina to be with the community in Reston, Virginia, in Sterling, Virginia, over the death of Nabra Hassan. And he just sort of saw some parallels there, and he wanted to come and talk to the youth, given that this affected directly the youth of the Muslim community there. And he wanted to have a talk with them to say, look, I went through a very similar thing. And he wanted to sort of be a big brother mentor figure to them in order for them to be able to get past this tragedy.
Well, and non-Muslims have been coming as well. You met a man named Mark Lamans who brought flowers. Let's listen.
In the times we live in, I think it's important for the decent majority of society to make sure to help make people feel that they're not as isolated as some folks want to make them.
Well, and Carmel, this murder in Virginia came at the same time that police in London were investigating that attack outside of a mosque by a white man, an attack on Muslims. So people were inclined to think that this was the same thing. But just to be clear, these teens, were they wearing head coverings? Was it apparent that they were Muslim?
For a group of them, they likely were wearing their headscarves or their hijabs. Nabra Hassanan certainly was. So it's pretty obvious what faith they are. The time of the day that they were out, 3:30 in the morning, it's pretty normal to be out at that time for people of our faith. You know, we're breaking our fast after 8:30 p.m. It's a very late night. You're fasting from 4 a.m. So for them to be out, it wasn't a case of, you know, why were they out so late? It was really a case of, you know, them sort of having a community and doing something kind of fun. Going out with their friends.
WAMU's Carmel Delshad, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There are some 1,000 unfilled positions in the federal government that require Senate confirmation. President Trump recently tweeted, "Dems are taking forever to approve my people." But out of the 558 key positions, 43 have been confirmed. Only 103 are in the confirmation process. 409 have no nominee at all. Max Dyer is president and CEO of Partnership for Public Service, a nonpartisan nonprofit that tracks political appointments. We spoke with him earlier today when there were 94 unconfirmed nominations. As we said, it's now up to 103 in the pipeline. But we asked, didn't President Obama get criticized for nominating slowly?
Yes, and it was a good criticism because he was slow. It just wasn't as slow as the current president is. We've never seen any president fall this far behind. These are the key people running our government, and they do everything, you know, most importantly, make sure that our country is safe, but it's all the functions of government, and the people at the top matter.
Name some of the positions that are unfilled.
Well, when you think about it, it's everything from the FEMA director, we're in hurricane season, to the head of the Transportation Safety Administration. North Korea, we don't have any assistant secretaries of state at all, and not the assistant secretary for East Asia and the Pacific. So you think about the issue of the day, likelihood is the federal government's involved, and likely is that the key leadership is not in place to make sure the government responds well.
Well, no ambassadors to Germany, France, India, or South Korea. No deputy secretaries of agriculture, education, labor, no secretary of the army, no head of NASA. But we should rush to point out that it's not as if nobody's doing any of this work. There are acting people in many of these jobs.
Yeah, and that's a very important distinction to make. We have a phenomenal career workforce, but since they are acting, to me the right metaphor is they're the equivalent of the substitute teacher, maybe an amazing educator, but because they're the substitute teacher, they don't have the perceived authority by those around them.
Well, it's just props for people who would be substitute teachers. We just want to say that. It's a tough job. But what do you think is going on here? Is this, as the Trump administration says, Democrats slowing things down? There are 90 people somewhere in the confirmation process. Or is this deliberate by the Trump administration? He has talked about wanting to downsize government, just leave some of these seats empty. Or is this just a new, untested administration that doesn't know how to work in this political process and maybe just doesn't know how to do this?
Door number three.
Really?
It's certainly the case that there is some blame to go around, and you have longer nomination to confirmation times than you've had historically, but not markedly so. The Senate can't confirm people that aren't nominated to them, and the real issue is that there haven't been enough people put before the Senate. I don't think this is deliberate. There are acting individuals in all these jobs. I think that the real issue here is you have a team that is unfamiliar with government process. They fell behind early. Pre-election, they had a very robust preparation process for the transition. In fact, Chris Christie and Rich Bagger, who ran the process for him, did about as good a job as anyone has ever done before. The wheels really came off the bus after the election. And they continue to this day to believe that they can run everything through a really small pipe of the White House and a small group of people. The government is big enough that you have to operate in parallel. And that includes making sure you have people focused on personnel that don't get drawn into all the other crises of the day.
You know, there's something else that's going on. Last week, the Energy Department under Rick Perry announced that it would be closing its Office of International Climate and Technology. This was formed in 2010 to give technical advice to other countries on how to reduce emissions. Now, President Trump has said he doesn't believe in much of the science of global warming. So the presumption was that this was a political move to get rid of that office. But the Energy Department says these jobs will be absorbed into other offices. So when it comes to offices being eliminated, are you seeing that? And do you think that is, you know, seeing fat and wanting to get rid of redundancy? Or is it wanting to get rid of things that are not politically aligned with the administration?
So I think there's no question but that the federal government needs to be modernized. There's no other democracy on the planet that has this number of political appointees a new administration has to put in place. The president has issued an executive order to review the functioning of government, which I think is extremely positive. The way to get there, though, however, is not simply to fail to fill these critical jobs. There are also going to be some positions, but they really are at the margin, where there's a difference in policy that leads this administration to get rid of an office or to invest more in some other area. That's part of the political process. What we're seeing today, however, is more fundamental, a failure to do the most basic governance responsibility, and that is to ensure that the team is on the field, that leaders are in place. And again, it's problematic in literally every area of concern that the federal government is responsible for.
Max Steyer, president and CEO of Partnership for Public Service, a nonpartisan nonprofit. They track political appointments and nominations. Max, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, what happens when two ambulances, sirens blaring, get to an intersection at the same time? Which one gets to go first? It's a scenario that doesn't happen often, but when it does, can add precious seconds to responding time. Now, Arizona is one of seven places in the country testing new technology that transmits real-time road information to vehicles with the goal of improving road safety. Casey Kuhn of KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
As cars get smarter, so do transportation departments. And if the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration passes a proposed rule, all automakers will have to include vehicle-to-vehicle communication in every new car.
It happens so fast that I can't get the little steps that are occurring for you guys to visualize.
Larry Head and I are riding in a test van equipped with multiple screens of numbers and maps. Head directs the University of Arizona's Transportation Institute and works with Maricopa County, which includes Metro Phoenix. His team has developed a system to connect traffic signals and cars.
So the idea is the cars are talking to each other. They can also talk to the infrastructure. They can talk to the traffic signals and say, here I am. And the traffic signals can say, oh, I see you're there. Let me give you a green light and let you go through.
One map shows the lane lines.
This is a high definition map. This isn't what you get from Google.
It's like a special dialect, car talk, if you will.
I like to call it the language of the road, right? And it's going to begin speaking to you, and it's going to be an active part of what you get in your vehicle, hopefully to keep drivers more engaged and reduce accidents.
Imagine a Wi-Fi router on top of a traffic signal, firing information like crash sites or school zones through wavelengths. The car would have a sensor, like a laptop, taking that information and telling the driver what to expect. For now, Maricopa County Department of Transportation is testing it on emergency vehicles. Faisal Salim is the Smart Program Drive Manager with the county.
Definitely the systems improve the safety of the responders. And then the second goal is to improve the response time.
He says when the emergency vehicles have the technology, the traffic signal will change its pattern to give one priority if there are two at an intersection.
It's the future that we are looking forward to. because this is just one application. U.S. DOT has more than 50 applications.
Those applications range from smartphone apps that can change a crosswalk signal for an individual to improving vehicle flow, which reduces emissions. For traffic planners like Denise Lacey, this technology will mean a shift in how congestion is managed on the roadways.
We have to change our mode of thinking a little tiny bit to try and determine how we prepare for that in the future, and there's a lot of studies going on for that nationwide.
As this information is used to find where cars are at a given time, the inevitable question comes up: how is my car's data going to be used? UA Transportation Institute Director Larry Head says the system has been designed to make it impossible to keep and track that kind of data.
So every 5 minutes, the vehicle changes its ID. And there's nothing in the message that goes out over the wave that is identifiable back to the vehicle.
And the next question, what if the system's hacked? Head says it's a huge concern, and the project is developing countermeasures.
What we don't want are fake cars out there. Somebody driving down the road saying, I'm going to tell everybody I'm 10 cars, and clearing the road so they can get through.
Back in the van, Head and his crew come to a stoplight where another emergency vehicle with the connected car technology is approaching. This is the critical point where the system should tell the signal to accommodate the vehicle with more priority.
Now the signal just changed to red. Now what happened?
In the van, you can see in real time how the map on the screen changes. It's stop and go with a delay to the other vehicle because there are cars on the road. And this is not a test track. It's being tested on the busy local streets.
So there we got our green and we get to go.
The Institute is still working out bugs and testing the new technology. The goal is starting in 2021. Every new car will have those sensors and could be coming to a road near you. For Here and Now, I'm Casey Kuhn.
President Trump says he's on a mission to modernize the federal government. He's appointed his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to lead that effort. And yesterday, Trump and Kushner met with leaders from some of the top tech firms in the U.S., including Apple, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. Here was Apple CEO Tim Cook speaking with the president.
The U.S. should have the most modern government in the world, and today it doesn't. And it's great to see the effort that Jared is putting in working on things that will pay back in 5 and 10 and 20 years.
Which brings us to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of Tech Policy and Politics for Recode. He joins us from Washington. Tony, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And you were there at the White House yesterday. What do we know about what was discussed in this meeting with tech leaders?
Yeah, I was there. It's all about bringing the U.S. government into the digital age. There's long been this belief in Washington, throughout the rest of the country, that the U.S. government's pretty slow to adapt to new technology. Some of the stories that Jared Kushner, the president's top aide and son-in-law, told while he was opening at yesterday's events involved folks at the Pentagon using floppy disks in order to save information, and trouble at the Department of Veterans Affairs that makes it hard for veterans to obtain their medical records. So there's a wide belief throughout government that something has to be done to improve the way the U.S. buys technology, and the Trump administration called on some of the leading technology companies for advice on how to do that.
Did they give any advice? Did they have any solutions?
Oh, they gave a lot of advice. There's a lot of folks in Silicon Valley who want the government to make it easier to buy their products and services. Amazon sells lots of stuff to the U.S. government. So do other companies like Oracle and Intel that were in the room just yesterday. So folks there said that the government had to lower barriers. And then they also asked the White House to address some policy challenges, things that make it hard for them to do business, like high-skilled immigration. You know, tech companies really want the Trump administration to allow them to hire more foreign workers, whereas the president has looked to impose restrictions on immigration. So that was one of the friction points between Trump and the tech industry for a long time. And it's something that came up yesterday as well.
And did we know what the response was from the Trump administration to that issue, to the immigration issue in particular?
Well, generally speaking, the Trump administration told tech companies that it understands their concerns. The president, when he spoke at the end of the day, said he wanted to do his part to help tech companies hire the folks they wanted to hire, which was a bit of a departure from what Trump had said on the campaign trail as he talked about limiting those visas that are awarded to foreign engineers of various sorts. Privately, there was a bit of a clash between Apple CEO Tim Cook and the president over issues like healthcare and immigration. But even there, Trump said at the end of their conversation, according to sources, is that he was exploring comprehensive immigration reform, which came as a bit of a shock to folks who were in the room. But, you know, at the very least, people like Jared Kushner and others told the tech industry that they wanted to work with them on high-skilled immigration.
Do these tech leaders still face the same kind of trouble from back home, let's say, in Silicon Valley, for even going to a meeting like this? We know that Elon Musk from Tesla was not there. He recently stepped down from two of the president's councils in protest.
You know, tech companies definitely face this potential for backlash. There were smaller groups that were organizing protests out in Silicon Valley. They were trying to get their bosses to sit out of this meeting because of some of the things that Trump has said, you know, whether it's about immigration or about climate change. You know, with Elon Musk, it was specifically because of the president's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. As he faced protests from some of his own, you know, customers for working with Trump, Elon kept saying, hey, you know, having a seat at the table means I can talk to the president about my views. But after the president didn't listen to him and didn't stay in the climate pact, Elon Musk said he had no choice but to leave and stop advising the president. But I think it's a telling sign that none of the tech companies that were in the room yesterday were willing to confirm their attendance before they appeared there. It really read to a lot of us that they were still afraid of being the subject and the target of protests in Silicon Valley by some of their employees who remain as vocal as ever in their opposition to Trump.
Well, what about Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon? I saw a photograph of him sitting, I think, two people away from President Trump. He did not look all that happy. And of course, he just did a big deal, Amazon buying Whole Foods for $13.7 billion. But Trump has attacked him and said he'll go after Bezos for antitrust.
Yeah, that certainly looms over that deal, right? We're talking about the president on the campaign trail who said he would give Jeff Bezos some problems if he became president. And at the time, that was partly related to the fact that Jeff Bezos, in a personal capacity, owns the Washington Post, right, which has written just, you know, a couple stories about the president in recent weeks. At the end of the day, Jeff Bezos and his deal with Whole Foods will have to obtain the government's approval in order to proceed. That'll be handled by folks who aren't this president. And Trump has attacked other deals that have, you know, still gone through that have been okay, even though he's been opposed to them, like AT&T's bid for Time Warner. But in terms of folks being uncomfortable at the meeting itself, there were photos that make it seem like folks didn't want to be there. But at the end of the day, all of them said that they appreciated working with Trump on modernizing federal government stuff.
That's Tony Rahm, senior editor of Tech Policy and Politics for Recode. Tony, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.